Hello and welcome to Pod Songs, where we interview inspirational people in service to others as inspiration for a new song. Today, our guest is the writer Steve Erickson, and my co-host and musical collaborator is Aidan Baker. Hello, Aidan.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. In Berlin, you are?
I'm in Berlin now, yeah.
And you're a Canadian musician?
I am.
Maybe for people that haven't heard of you, could you just give a little short introduction to yourself?
I work both as a solo musician under my own name and with my partner Leah with a project called Nadja. And both are sort of in the realms of ambient / experimental music. The big difference being volume for the most part. So my solo work tends to be more minimal and delicate sometimes, I guess. Whereas Nadja uses sort of the tropes of metal and industrial music in a sort of ambient context. So it's about big sound and sort of overwhelming sonic obliteration or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful you did that introduction because I would have buggered out because, you know, you got so many genres, you're so many references and it's, I don't want to call it doom metal or drone metal.
I mean, that's something I like about the project is that it allows us to sort of be tangential with our genre names and explore a lot of different varieties of sounds and try to incorporate it into our sonic aesthetic.
Mm. Oops, I just made a new genre there. That's what you must say after doing some tracks.
Right.
It sounds like super fun music to make because, so I read in one interview that you record without using a computer, but now you do use a computer.
Yeah. I mean, I have used a computer for a long time, actually. When we started out, we were doing stuff on cassette 4-track, but that was a much more lo-fi years, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that was partially by choice to get that sort of cassette lo-fi aesthetic sound. But once we started getting more into the industry, I guess, and signed to a bigger label, we felt that it was necessary to get a bit more high fidelity, I suppose.
Mm. And also because you're so prolific, really, we're talking an album, up to 4 albums a year. Did I count that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. With different projects, of course, it's not always, with Nadja or even solo. I have a variety of collaborative projects as well.
Mm-hmm. And you're primarily a guitarist, is that? You do other things as well. You do the flute and the drums.
Yeah,
and
that, right? I mean, my formal training was in flute, but I generally focus on guitar these days.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're most famous for, your style of, you get a lot of references for your guitar work. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it sounds like wonderful music to make. It's great to listen to. Also, so much more liberating because I'm used to I'm more of a traditional songwriter, So you need the lyrics and the chords, and it's very repetitive, But your music sounds like so much more fun to make.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of embrace the abstraction of it, and that sort of becomes the compositional tool in a way.
Mm. And so you perform with your wife, Leah, Nadja.
Yeah.
So how did that come about? Did you meet her before you were a couple? Or?
No. I guess, I don't know. We met early 2000s and originally I was just doing Nadja by myself, in the studio. But then I started getting demands for live performances and I didn't really feel like I could pull it off by myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Leah to join the project initially just to play live. But then that kind of changed the impetus of the project a bit. And so she joined properly and we started recording as a duo and such. And it really gave new life to the project and allowed it to move outside of the studio and into the performative realm.
Mm. And is Nadja a literary reference?
In part, there's the André Breton novel called Nadja, sort of a classic of surrealism. But there's also a 90s vampire movie by Michael Almeida.
Mm-hmm.
His That's a very sort of atmospheric, black and white, throwback kind of vampire movie.
Yeah, there's so much. You're also a published poet.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be one of those interviews where I sit back with a dictionary, I think, and or a cultural dictionary as well, because where you swap all these references and because, yeah, I'm no way qualified to arbitrate this one.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So why Steve Erickson?
He's been a longtime favorite of mine specifically, and Leah's also read a lot of his work. I really found him kind of a unique voice, and a unique perspective, both in terms of like how he presents like reality, I suppose, but also in the way that he writes. And I feel a certain kinship in way that he's got sort of a fluidity to his genre, that he's not really science fiction or speculative fiction or literary fiction, but kind of an amalgamation of all of that. And I feel that like that, I feel relates to my own sort of fluidity in terms of genre and how I incorporate different styles.
Yeah, he seems really like the writer's writer.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And I know I've been called a musician's musician a few times before too. So.
It's a very polite term for when you don't have, you're not super famous, but you're well known and you're respected in the right places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Wow. This is the musician's musician interviewing the writer's writer. It's going to be a great episode.
Yeah. Let's see.
So he's most famous for Zeroville. Is that right? I saw there's a James Franco made a movie of it.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably one of his better known books. I haven't actually seen the movie.
You'd probably be disappointed.
Well, yeah, to be honest, I was a little concerned about whether I would hate it or like it or not. And maybe after this interview, I'll find the courage to actually check it out and see. But
Well, if you love a book, you know, you're very attached to it.
It's
going to be virtually impossible to make that. Yeah, what you see in your head.
And I know there's also a radio play version of his last novel, Shadowbond, on the BBC, that the BBC did, which I was tempted to check out before the interview as well, but haven't yet.
Mm. Shadowbond, is that a reference to Berlin and Germany as well? Is it?
Not really. The Shadowbond is like this secret highway that exists in America that you can only access when you fall asleep at the wheel.
Really?
Yes.
He has some crazy ideas in his. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So how did you first come across him? Which was the first book you read?
I think it was either Rubicon Beach or Amnesia Scope. And I discovered those, I guess, shortly after they came out in the mid to late 90s, when I was working in a bookstore in the suburban wasteland of Toronto, and big sort of sprawling big box bookstore, and a bit of a cultural wasteland. So finding, just sort of stumbling across these books that happened to be in the section. I didn't do the ordering, so I don't know how they actually ended up to be in our store, and just read the description, thought sounds interesting, and was immediately hooked thereupon.
So what does he write about? Is it sort of, what's the way to describe it? Sort of a modern contemporary wasteland?
I mean, that's kind of the one of the appealing aspects, is that it's very hard to pinpoint exactly what he writes about, because it is very focused on an individual perspective, but at the same time, it's dealing with very grandiose themes of like history and perception, mm-hmm. and the nature of reality and stuff like that. I guess to be succinct, it's sort of explorations of the duality of existence. So there's a surface layer of reality that is one thing, and then there is always some sort of hidden, not necessarily a dark side, but mm-hmm. an ambivalent side to that reality that sometimes we can access and sometimes we can't.
Mm. It's a very poetic way to put it, yeah. Yeah, he gets referenced alongside Margaret Atwood, Rushdie, Okri, Pamuk, mm-hmm. David Foster Wallace. Yeah, this is the who's who of... avant-pop, he's described as surrealism, slipstream.
Avant-pop?
Yeah.
Okay. Slipstream is definitely true, yeah.
Seems to remind you of Chuck Palahniuk as well, that sort of dystopian with the character.
To a certain degree, yeah. I think Chuck Palahniuk, I was going to say Chuck Palahniuk is maybe a little more funny, but I guess he's also pretty dark at times too. But yeah.
Modern American pulp, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's about as much as I can comment on something that I have not read, and I'm just looking forward to listening to the conversation.
So, okay.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, he's written... have you read all the books?
I've read all of his fiction, and he has a couple nonfiction books, but I've only read one of them.
Okay. And who else do you read? Who else was on the short list for... we had quite a few names for you to...
Yeah.
Are they all writers? And
they were writers or filmmakers, mostly. Mm-hmm. Nicola Barker was one. She's one of Leah's favorite writers, and I quite like her a lot as well. Lydia Millay. I can't remember what else we gave you from the
list. We can try for some of them next time, because that's just ideally. I love these heavy intellectual episodes, because I get to learn something, and it's really I love the meaty episodes,
right?
Cool. Not just somebody. It's better to interview somebody who wrote the movie than starred in it, I find.
yeah, I can imagine that's true.
Yeah, they've got a little more substance to them in my experience. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. Where does he live, do you know?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, of course. Yeah, life there must be good for the inspiration of so many weird characters.
Yeah, I think so. He's written before how he considers LA to be sort of a blank slate of a city that you can project anything onto it. And
right.
The city can become anything you want, essentially.
And Berlin's a bit like that too, or...
To a certain degree, yeah.
How long have you been there?
About 12 years now, actually.
Yeah.
And it has changed a lot in recent years, and kind of sort of in a very accelerating kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Not always for the best, it seems, but I guess that's kind of true everywhere at the moment. But it is a sort of surprisingly different from the city that we moved to in like 2010.
Yeah, well, it was always going to be. Whenever I used to live in Amsterdam, we go to Germany regularly, and Berlin was obviously there. You didn't make any money at the gigs there because everyone in the audience was an artist as well.
Right, and had no money themselves.
Had no money. But the vibe, was so artistic, and it was always, but it always seemed to be a case of, it was great. You should have been here 5 years ago. It was amazing then.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's changed so much. Yuppified. And...
But even Amsterdam has changed so much too. I'm sure you've seen that when you go back as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Change beyond. But it was never, Amsterdam was never as cool as Berlin. I mean, Berlin.
No.
The atmosphere was so, because when I went there, we still had some, still half the places were kind of squats.
Right.
Though they had these, so much cooler atmosphere when something's underground and you have to go through a hole in the wall to get there and
to access the venue and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Then once everything's regulated and brightly lit, doesn't have the same.
Yeah. It's not quite the same, is it?
No. Are there still places like that? Do you play much in the city?
Yeah. There are a handful of places like that, but a lot of them have disappeared, unfortunately.
Yeah. So gentrified.
It's definitely a lot shinier than it used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because all those bloody artists, they have kids, and then all their priorities change, and then they gentrify the area, and all the shops change, and you become the thing that you move to get away from.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, but
where are you living now? You're in Italy?
Yeah, I'm in the south of Italy, under the Amalfi Coast. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
An hour and a half south of Napoli. I'm really in the countryside, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
Yeah, you have to move to these, you have to live in these cities where you're young enough to, I mean, you're still getting, working on it, but I much prefer the quiet now and the,
right.
Yeah, peace and quiet.
And how long have you been there?
About 12 years, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we met my girlfriend traveling. We're in New Zealand. I was, doing couch concerts in New Zealand, and then we'd travel together for 8 months around Asia, cycling and playing. And she danced, and I played songs.
Right.
So yeah, it was fun times. And then we moved back to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could have met a girl from Birmingham or Dortmund.
Dortmund? Is Birmingham your hometown?
No, but it's just the shit all I could think of first.
Ah, right. Yes. True enough.
Yeah, now we've got the sea right here. You can, 5 minutes to drive to the sea. And
right.
Yeah, I can see the sea out the window and that, fresh air. And it's a very low cost of living. And I can do my things quite comfortably here. So.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, we've just had a child as well. So I'm fully in. I'm a paid and bought up and paid member now of Italian society. Yeah. Do you ever get to tour Italy?
Sorry, say that
again. Have you ever played over here? You probably played in the north, maybe not. Or
you, Sicily, mostly or? In the north. We played in Napoli in March this year, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And we've played Rome a few times, but no, I never really further south than that.
Well, there's no money down here. It's the...
Yeah.
Not enough big venues. And
no.
Such a long way to drive down because it's just such a long... So, and it's not on the way to anywhere. I mean, if you're going to...
Yeah, this is true.
you can... It's... Africa is the next stop if you keep going down.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of gas and a lot of... Not many places to play. I know.
Yeah. Well, we do like touring in Italy. We have some good friends in and around Milan and Torino. So we've played up there.
Yeah. No, it's a great place to play and you get good food and nice place to sleep, but it doesn't pay anything.
Yeah.
In my experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't even have any much festivals down here. Everything's in the north, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you get to play many festivals? Are you?
Not so much. I mean, it's certainly not like the sort of summer festivals, because I don't think our music is particularly suited for that. So if we do, it's usually the more sort of artsy.
Yeah, but those must be, be very cool. Also Eastern Europe and places like that. Your music is so niche, but you have dedicated fans, I mean, all over the world, no? You must get...
Yeah, seems that way, yeah.
Yeah. Do you get people writing to you from all around the world?
Yeah. Yeah, we were just on tour in Japan last month too. So
oh, exciting! Yeah,
it was pretty nice.
Yeah, that must have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're passionate fans there, no?
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting how like music is so. When they embrace a subculture there, they become very focused on that.
Yeah, you must have felt like a superstar.
To see.
Yeah, they say a prophet is never recognized in his own land.
Mm. True.
So what was some of the highlights, some of the gigs there, some of the experiences?
We did some like sightseeing around Osaka and Kyoto and stuff, and that was quite nice to do. We did play a matinee show in Tokyo, which was a little kind of bizarre. We did sound check at 9:30 in the morning, which was a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah. Especially with the time difference.
Yeah. And then the show started at noon or 11 even, I think. It was over by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which was kind of nice, but it was a bit kind of funny being in a darkened club at the middle of the day.
Yeah. Like, what do I do now?
Yeah.
I must have had that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard the yen is at a 30-year low, so it must have been cheap there.
It was. I mean, unfortunately, we got paid in yen, but
of course, yeah.
Spending time there and was a lot cheaper than the last few times we visited. So
yeah,
that was one advantage.
Yeah, but I forgot they pay you. Yeah, you should have negotiated to be paid in dollars or something.
I thought of that.
Yeah, those are the trips. That's what it's all about with the music. Now, if you can do a trip like that, wonderful. Yeah. And what's next in your horizon? I mean, have you got how many albums coming out next year?
We don't have anything scheduled for release right now. There's a couple things that are in progress that still need to be finished up. And then we'll probably have a tour in February. Will be the first one of the new year. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, we don't have anything scheduled, so it's a bit open at the moment.
Mm. And so you'll get plenty of time to work on new stuff?
Yeah, hopefully.
Great. Well, I can't wait to hear what you come up with for this interview. Have you done any music inspired by his work before, his writings?
Not really, I don't think. I have thought about it, and I was thinking about it in the context of this interview as I was reading, doing some research and stuff. So I have some ideas.
Yeah. Maybe get featured in his next movie. That would be
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Especially if you can. Have you ever done music for film first? You would have thought it would be a natural.
Yeah. I've done some, not a lot, but a little bit.
Yeah. For the right kind of movie, you would be perfect. No.
Yeah.
What kind of things have you done?
I've done a couple documentaries actually. Mm-hmm. Recently did a short for a production company in Toronto that was kind of like a gritty punk story of the streets kind of thing. That was interesting. Mm-hmm. And most recently I've been working on a soundtrack for a video game actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which should be out next year, hopefully. It's been a long process because making a video game is a very involved thing, but so it'd be interesting to see that come together.
Yeah, how much music time wise is needed for a video game?
Actually, I'm not sure how much it will end up in the final cut of the game itself, but there's at least, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours worth of material I think that I sent to the developer.
Wow. So they loop some things and
They loop some things and then use some standalone sound effect things and then have transitional music and stuff. So it's be an interesting mix.
That's great. Well, I'm just checking this, Steve. I just realized that he had another link with him. So I hope he doesn't join this other room. Because sometimes I never make a room in Zoom.
Oh, you just have a dedicated one, yeah.
Just have a dedicated, one room. I did send it to him, so let's hopefully he just comes here. He's not late yet, so. Okay. And how do you go about getting these gigs, like a video games or movies? Do people just write to you? Or
yeah, that was just a fan of my music wrote to me and asked if I wanted to do this.
Wow, that would have been exciting coming out of the blue like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, a movie, but a video game, I can't imagine. Did you have to play some of the game to understand what to put in?
I haven't played it in its latest iteration, but I played some of the very earlier drafts just to have an idea of the aesthetic and the sort of the general play feel and stuff like this.
Mm, yeah. Right. So that's, this should be a piece of cake today then if you've done a movie and a video game. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's something different for you though. Writing songs to order. Of course, you have complete creative control now. You can do, whatever. And whatever the mood takes, I'm sure it's going to be. He's such an interesting guy. I haven't actually read any of his books. So I'm really, one of the reasons I do this of podcasting is to discover new things, as many listeners do. And I've been introduced to some wonderful people.
Oh, cool.
he did join the right link. So here he is. Hey, Steve.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good. You made it.
We made it.
Wonderful.
It took several months, but we're here now.
We are. Yeah, we finally made it. Well, let me introduce you to Aiden, who's the musician in Berlin.
Hello, nice to meet you. E meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you for inviting me to do this.
No worries. Aiden's going to create a song inspired by this conversation.
Okay.
Whichever way it leads.
Sorry?
No pressure. Which it could be, he's going to create a song inspired by our conversation together.
That's great.
Yeah.
I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah, me too.
Me too. So, yeah, it's morning for you in California, I guess.
That's right. It's about 10 in the morning, and you're in Berlin, is that correct?
I'm in Berlin, yeah.
And how long have you guys been there?
We moved here in 2010, so 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah, which is kind of the longest either of us have lived anywhere apart from like childhood homes. So, yeah. I don't know if we've reached a threshold necessarily, but I know we're both kind of feeling a little transitional at the moment and wondering where might be next, if anywhere. I was saying to Jack earlier that Berlin has changed quite drastically in the last few years.
I would have thanked you.
Yeah, which I think is a very common thing for Berliners to say and has been for probably the last two decades. But it's certainly becoming less of an easy city to live in, which was one of the sort of one of the big appealing factors to us when we left Toronto.
And can I ask how has that become that way? What is less easy about it?
Well, a lot of it's due to rather short-sighted decisions made by the city government, like selling off of real estate and allowing development projects that don't make sense. And I don't know if you heard about the airport here, but it was supposed to open in 2014, I think, and didn't until maybe 2 years ago, just because of, I don't know, gross incompetence. And and now the airport is open, but quite dogged with problems and really kind of a horrendous experience trying to get out of the city even.
The Germans aren't typically known for gross incompetence.
No, except Berlin. This is why Berlin is kind of the butt of the jokes of the rest of the country for this kind of reason that, yeah, we're cool, but we don't really get anything done.
I have a good friend who lived there several years and she loved it, but she said the winters were brutal. But maybe for you as a Canadian, that's not so much?
They are brutal. And it's not so much the cold, but it's the darkness. From December until February, it's pretty dark all the time and you don't see any sun.
Right.
And so even though Toronto gets much colder, we did have more sunlight there. So there was more daylight. And I think that makes a big difference. So I know a lot of friends who came from California or Texas or somewhere in the south of the US had real trouble with the winters here.
I was staying in Dublin for a while, this was a few years ago, working on what is my last novel. And I was there around this time of the year and was just stunned to wake up at nine in the morning and it was like nighttime.
Yeah.
And then the sun was going down at 3.
Yeah.
The afternoon. So
yeah, it's much the same here.
Yeah.
In some ways it's encouraging a sort of hermit like behavior, which can be nice for working on things.
Right. Yeah.
I guess we try to take the advantage of that and get some work done over the winter months.
Uh-huh. Right. So you're thinking about maybe moving on.
Well, we've considered it, but The issue is where to go.
Of course.
Going back to Canada seems like kind of like an impossibility, to be honest.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. Especially Toronto is ludicrously expensive city. Trying to continue our existence as we are now, like our artistic path or career or whatever in Toronto would be very difficult.
What are the politics like where you are now? Because we're coming into what I think is going to be, if it'll be a dreadfully momentous year or a momentously dreadful year, but.
I was going to suggest possibly an apocalyptic year, but who knows? Things are definitely moving to the right everywhere in Europe right now, which is kind of scary. It's been happening sort of slowly over the last few years, but especially since the pandemic, things are definitely shifting more rapidly now than they were. And there's also kind of a weirdness where the left is becoming right. And I don't know. I don't know if you subscribe to the idea that politics is on a circular spectrum.
Yeah,
but
right. So the farther left you go, the farther right you wind up being.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does kind of seem to be happening.
Right. I think we have that phenomenon here too, where the left of whatever is the mainstream left winds up somewhere where a lot of MAGA people are.
It is a bit weird for us politically here because we don't have the right to vote.
And
haven't for the last decade plus. And we only recently got the right to vote in Canada again after it was taken away for a little while. So we can vote now in the Canadian federal elections, but we have no voice, political voice in Germany, which feels a little uncomfortable sometimes.
Right. Well, maybe you should go somewhere where you can vote then.
Yeah, that's is an attraction, definitely.
So what shall we talk about?
Yeah, good question.
I listened to your music, which some of which I liked a lot, and some of which reminded me of the kind of music I listen to on the rare occasions when I put on music when I'm writing.
Oh, really?
Usually I write to silence, but
yeah.
And especially I can't have anything on that has a vocal to it.
Right.
But the especially the piece you did for the Guy Madden. Movie was a little similar to the kind of music that I can put on when I work.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I enjoyed it.
We have a lot of people say that our music is very meditative, and that is, I don't know that that's necessarily a conscious goal in what we're doing, but it's certainly sort of a result. And even though, like with Nadja, with the band, with my wife and I, that we do is it's usually quite heavy and distorted and loud. I know a lot of people have said they used it to put their children to sleep.
Oh, really?
Yes.
But
I guess because there's sort of a lot of sort of white noise element to it. So
the heavy loud stuff or the meditative stuff?
No, the heavy loud stuff.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
The track to the Dario Argento was I it was a kind of wall of sound that really evocative. That's one of the movies on there that I haven't seen.
Oh, really?
But now I feel like I have.
Okay, that's good. I also wanted to send you a soundtrack we did for Stalker, but unfortunately it didn't turn out very well.
It didn't turn out well from a technical standpoint or from a creative standpoint?
Technical. Actually, the movie, the projection, I can't remember what happened. The subtitles on the movie stopped about halfway through, and the projectionist tried to fix it and ended up like losing the projection entirely. So there was about 15 minutes of sort of dead air that, I mean, we just played over the silence. But if anybody's trying to watch the movie and sync it with our recording, it doesn't work anymore, unfortunately.
One of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I like that. The Strugatskys are some of my favorite writers too.
What else have you written music to?
Well, I was just talking with Jack that I've been working on a soundtrack for a video game, which is a new thing for me, not something I've done before. And originally, when the developer approached me, we had all these very complicated ideas of how the music would be entwined with the action, and the actions of the game would cue certain levels of the music. Which we soon realized would be exceedingly difficult to program, and if not entirely impossible. So the idea got stripped down quite a bit, but curious to see how it's going to turn out. The game should be released next year sometime, and I haven't really seen a beta of it yet, so I don't really know how it's going to work at all.
When you're writing music for a video game, do they provide? See, my parlance, I think, is not updated enough for this. But when they invite you to write the music for a video game, do they provide you some kind of template that allows you to actually play the game, or are you just responding to a visual? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I did get like a very rough cut of the first 10 levels of the game as it was envisioned by the creator. And it changed significantly since that point, but it was, like a demo or like a rough draft, I guess. And he wanted me to both sort of provide sounds that were like Foley sounds, so sound effects and textural things, but then also more composed sections that were like transitional music or looping sections that could be used in the background as the action happened over top of it.
Do you play a lot of video games?
No.
Not at all?
I'm not particularly, not in a long time. I used to a bit, but I was never super into them, so My vocabulary too about video games was pretty non-existent. So talking with the developer about like the minutiae of the actual programming and stuff was completely beyond me.
I'm intellectually persuaded that this is an art form of the future, but I don't personally connect with it.
Yeah,
and I assume that is some limitation on my part, that I would think it involves reimagining the relationship between the art form and the audience. That is, the audience becomes a part of the creation in a way that that is not true of the art forms that that I'm more familiar with.
Yeah. I wonder how true that is, though, because everything is so scripted. So I suppose you do have a modicum of choice in that you control the action, but still you're still reacting to a set of commands and programs within the game itself.
Yeah. So the audience is essentially deluding itself that it has more freedom and choice than it actually does.
Sure. So welcome to life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting to think about. And when I originally envisioned doing the music, I wanted it to be more interactive, I guess would be the word, so that it was more responsive to the actions that the player was inputting to the game. And it didn't turn out that way because it was too complicated, but
it sounds complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be, but maybe not impossible if you find the right person.
Yeah. Yeah, David Bowie had that quote about, there's the art and the audience, and the space between is where the real art actually happens. And it seems to me, potentially, the video game would be the best example of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be.
Except that, as you say, that space where the audience thinks it has a certain amount of freedom is more scripted than it knows.
Than it might appear, yeah. Yeah. And so what are you working on, anything at this point, creatively?
The last novel I finished, I finished the rough draft the month that Trump announced his candidacy for the presidency in 2015, and by the time the novel came out, Trump had been elected.
Okay,
and it basically, the novel was about a lot of things, but in part, it was about the country coming apart.
Sure.
And a lot of critics said, here's the first Trump novel. Trump era novel.
Right.
And then when Trump became president, I felt like my imagination couldn't keep up with the unfolding
reality. Yeah, yeah.
And I stopped writing for a while. I did wind up writing a short kind of journal, if you will, about 2019 and 2020, that was both about the things that were going on in my life against the backdrop of the things that were going on in the country and of the world.
Right.
But I wondered if fiction was relevant anymore, or at least relevant for me.
Right.
And then a year ago, or actually the beginning of this year, I started writing something, which is a hybrid of novel and commentary. Because I just, I have no idea where it's going, and I'm not worrying about where it's going. But I realize I'm a writer, and this is the way I process stuff.
Sure.
Writing about it, right. Whether the writing is relevant or not, or whether it's publishable,
sure,
or no. So that's what I'm working on now. I kind of got distracted for a while because I was appointed chair of the creative writing department where I teach.
Right.
But I now have some time between now and next fall, really, where I can get back to writing this novel. The only thing, the only question is it going to be, is my creativity, such as it is, going to be overtaken again by what I think what's unfolding over the next year?
Right.
Because I do, you know, the year is, you know, I was thinking about it before we started this interview. I think it's unfolding as potentially the most momentous year since 1968 in terms of world history, with what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on here in the United States, and certainly in terms of U.S. history, I think it's potentially the most momentous year since 1932, if not 1864, when Abraham Lincoln ran for re-election. Right. So, you know, on some low-key, subdued level, I'm freaking out. and I'm going to need to try to find a way to reconcile the work I'm doing with my whatever my mental and emotional and psychological state is as the year, you know, unfolds.
Right. So, like as we were talking earlier about moving to Berlin, for us, it was kind of an escape as much as it was a career move. At the time, Berlin was a lot quieter, I guess, than it is now. Way fewer tourists and not as industry oriented. So I think one of our dissatisfactions with the city right now is that it feels less like a what's the word I want? An escape, I guess. Less a place to hide away from the world, so to speak. But where do you find another such place is the big question. So do you have something like that? Do you have a place where you go that you can get away from the reality of it all? Do you feel the need to do that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think I could, even if I wanted to. You know, I've got a job. I've got which I need to hang on to. I've got kids.
Sure,
they're grown, but still. And you know, where is that place at this point? Mm. Iceland? You know,
true.
I don't know. I mean, if it's not intrusive to ask, was there a reason you felt the need to leave Canada?
Well, it came down to sort of a decision of whether we wanted to be artists or not. And the reality of it was that if we moved to Europe, we could do that full time and survive, and which we couldn't in Canada.
So it was a matter of expense.
To a large degree, yeah. And at the time, I think the standard of living in Europe was better. I mean, it's hard to compare standards of living in some ways, because like the first apartment we had in Berlin was still coal heated, and you know, this is Western Europe still, and we're heating our house with coal.
I think of Berlin as much more modern than that, but
I mean, there are way fewer coal heated places these days, but they still exist. You still smell coal in the air sometimes.
Was it on what used to be the east side of the city, or was it?
The flat that we had was on the former east, yeah, but you still smell it in some parts of the west too.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it wasn't yet all economics. It was also this sort of idea that the city had a lot more to offer than Toronto did for us. It's much more relaxed, much comparable green space, I guess, but more, yeah, chill, inducive to creativity, and not just the same kind of rat race that Toronto had.
Oh, yeah. When you say that it feels like Europe is moving right, can you put your finger on anything in particular that is it immigration from Africa and the Middle East, or is it
that people are responding to, you mean? Or
the reason that people are moving right.
Yeah, the reason that's tough to say. Certainly in Germany, there's been a couple right-leaning parties that have gained political power in recent years that everybody was quite surprised that they actually did so. And they're very reactive parties or reactionary parties that they're responding to things like, yeah, immigration, foreigners, inflation, Germans' jobs being stolen by other people and stuff like this. So, yeah, they're not necessarily white supremacist or racist or neo-Nazi or whatever, but there's elements of that in their rhetoric, so which makes them scary.
Right. I guess what I was asking is why did they gain that power that surprised everybody? And I guess you just gave the answers.
I guess, yeah. I mean, other than that, it's kind of hard to pinpoint that shift, like how it happens and how people respond to that.
You know, I think it's the same thing here. I think it's some people feeling legitimately economically abandoned,
right,
by globalism, and then it's cultural changes that parts of the country
don't want to deal with.
Don't want to deal with, I mean, yeah. Gay marriage, say.
Yeah, yeah.
And more than anything else, though, it's the realization that sometime in the next quarter century, this will become a nation of minorities. There won't be a majority anything. And I just think there's tens of millions of white folks who are completely freaked out.
Yeah.
Fear of a non-white America, to paraphrase the title of an old Public Enemy album.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I think one of the positives about the changes in Berlin lately is that there are more people of color here, and there is more cultural and racial diversity than when we moved here, and certainly compared to the rest of the country.
Right.
And I'm sure that visibility is something that creates the backlash against it. But it's coming from Toronto, which is already a pretty diverse city. Seeing that happening in Berlin feels refreshing, I guess, to us, or a nice positive to see that kind of change happening.
Of course, you know, and here, you know, I don't think it's an accident that Trump is the guy who was elected to succeed Obama. You know,
yeah.
That,
yeah.
That, it's not an accident that Trump's entree into American politics was his baseless and racist contention that the first African American president wasn't a real American and wasn't a real president.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's all about backlash here too, but it's still going on. And, it's scary and sad. And
yes, it is.
And, And you know, the meaning of this country, I think, is pretty much up for grabs over the next. I think 12 months from now, we're going to know a lot about what kind of a country this is.
Yeah. Does this make you feel prophetic some way? Like your books are always sort of about dealing with these sort of cataclysmic changes in whatever, politics or morality. And as you say, we're saying how reality seems to have caught up to what you're writing. Is it like the progression of your books is becoming less fictional and more non-fictional? Well,
you know, I think that's what I was getting at earlier when I said, I can't keep up with it. You know, it's overtaken me. I guess a little bit pathetic when I think about it. I wrote a story. It was published in the Los Angeles Times Magazine in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
The title was American Weimar. And the opening line was, America wearies of democracy. So,
but on a personal level, like not thinking of yourself as part of a political spectrum or even part of society, does that sort of make you question your own artistic path, or does it frighten you or invalidate what the directions you've taken?
I don't feel invalidated, but it makes me question where I go next, for sure.
Sure, I can see that.
And I didn't used to do that. I mean, I never had a grand scheme. You know, right. I kind of always followed my instincts. Often there was something in the last novel that turned out to be the seed of the next novel.
Right.
There was a feeling of a kind of continuum there. And yeah, that continuum feels is no longer feeling as natural. It's feeling like it's been, you know, severed might be too strong a word, but it's been
challenged, upset, at least.
Challenge for sure.
Yeah.
Upset, shaken. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I don't have any problem standing by what I've written before, but I'm having a problem standing by whatever I'm writing now.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm trying to, you know, just like I say, for the sake of my own sanity, I'm trying to kind of set that aside. I'm trying to not worry about that.
Sure. Yeah, because it would be detrimental to the process, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I mean, just listening to your music, I would imagine that you don't spend a lot of time worrying about who the audience for this music is going to be.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, do you kind of assume that the audience will find it?
Yeah, to a certain degree.
Or do you count on the audience to find it? Maybe that's a better way of putting it. You leave it to the audience to find it.
Yeah, I think that's more true, more accurate. Allowing people to discover it, allowing people to experience it the way they want to experience it. I started my musical career. I mean, I've done music all my life, but this kind of music I started early 2000s. And I feel like the internet at that time is not the internet that is existing today. And I was talking about this recently with a friend, and how late 90s and early 2000s, that the internet was like a collaborative space where people would, you know, meet and share ideas and stuff. And there was a positivity there that doesn't seem to be there anymore. And that's not just about tech bubbles bursting or market bubbles or whatever. It's the idea that there's this mutual support doesn't exist anymore. And I think my career was able to start because of finding these people that would be my audience that I wouldn't necessarily have access to if the internet didn't exist. So, you know, I began releasing with micro labels around the world, and this allowed me to get like a global name happening. That was a result of this sort of positivity of this online community that was a positive network. And I mean, now, of course, we still have an internet presence, but we feel obliged to do so because it's about marketing and it's about maintaining those connections with fans. So yeah, finding that audience now feels like a very different process than when we first started making this kind of music.
And when you started making this kind of music, was that okay? A couple of questions. First, was it a natural progression from whatever you were doing before, or was there a distinct shift to a new thing? And the second question being, was that progression or shift occasioned by some particular revelation or
No, I think it was a pretty natural progression that came out of what I was listening to and people I was interacting with, both in person and playing live, but also online too, that this sort of like the response from people on the internet allowed me to participate in this kind of stuff, or encouraged me to keep making this kind of music that otherwise I probably would have been fairly isolated doing.
Who do you listen to, or who has been important to you?
I mean, there's a lot of people, I guess.
Is this the kind of question you hate?
Not necessarily. It's just, it's hard to pinpoint because it changes so much, right?
I know, because when I get that question, I don't hate it. And I think it's an interesting question, but I find, it is difficult to.
Yeah, because it changes depending on all sorts of circumstances. But I did read that you mentioned PJ Harvey as someone you thought was canonical or something like that.
Right.
And she was definitely somebody that maybe that was kind of a pivotal point of when I first heard Rid of Me when it came out. And I thought, oh, okay, this is a new direction. This is something that I haven't really heard before and I want to explore further in the early 90s. And I still listen to her today. So she's definitely somebody has been a lasting influence. Right. But also, I guess Bill Frisell has been a big influence in the metal world. Justin Broderick, an English musician who had a band called Godflesh, he's been a big influence as well, sonically, definitely, but both sort of technically in the way I play.
I'll just point out, I didn't ask who had influenced you, because I do kind of hate that question.
Oh, okay. Who am I listening to?
Who had been important to you in whatever way?
Important. Yeah. Well, I'd say all three of those.
When I was 12, a very white boy growing up in a very white bubble, hearing Ray Charles the first time.
Okay.
Was a revelation.
Sure.
So that kind of thing.
Right. I guess because the influence slash importance is kind of attached to what I do. They're I can't really separate that. So they're important to me because they're influences.
Okay. I just didn't want to tie you down to that that particular word, because sometimes you hear you're influenced by people you don't especially like. So I think I asked you what you're doing next. Was that the Stalker soundtrack, or is there something?
No, Stalker was last year, I think, that we did that. Yeah, at the moment we're kind of in between things. Just coming off a bunch of touring in the fall. We were in Japan last month for a couple of weeks, playing shows and doing touristy stuff. So we're going into that dark winter period where it's time to think about a new project.
What was your reception like in Japan?
It was good. We've been there three or four times. I think this was our fourth visit now. And I really find it a fascinating place. And it's really great to play music there. I don't know if you've noticed from your own experience, but like subcultures there are very niche, but very dedicated. So it's kind of fascinating how if you're rockabilly in Japan or something, then rockabilly is your life. And that sort of translates to the music that we're doing as well.
No, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I think you're entirely right. Yeah. For all the stereotyping of the Japanese as very orderly people, I was fascinated by just how chaotic Tokyo is.
Yeah.
And how cab drivers who've been driving there for 20 years still have to pull out a map to find places. And the way that on some streets, the addressing is not geographical, but it's chronological.
I've noticed that too.
That conflict between the orderly Japanese character, if that's not too racist a way of putting it, this element of chaos is really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and just walking the streets in Tokyo and riding the trains is kind of an adventure in itself.
Yeah. And the city is just huge. So it's not only huge, but maybe because ever since the Second World War, they just kind of add stuff onto it. And so there is no real rhyme or reason to a lot of it.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And then there's a weird sense of whimsy too, where you find animated cartoon statues just randomly in the middle of the street or a park or something.
And a very, an almost insufferably cute whimsy. And this emphatically childlike whimsy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's interesting to see older people in Japan because they're almost surprising in a way.
Yeah. So how long were? Oh, you said you've been there four times.
Yeah. That's over the course of the last like decade or so.
Right.
Yeah.
Where else have you toured?
We've toured, most of, I think every European country we've been to, except maybe a couple. We used to play in Russia quite a bit. Who knows when or if we'll be able to go back there at this point. But it was always quite interesting to go and experience, especially some of the smaller cities outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, to see just the way, life was there and the reality of their experience. It's pretty cool. Yeah, we have toured the States a bit, but not for a long time now. Just because it's not so easy to do this. Yeah.
Are there some countries that are more receptive than others?
Yeah. In Europe, we find generally the Eastern countries are more interested in what we're doing. So yeah, in Poland and Czech Republic, Slovenia and Slovakia, we've played there quite a bit. I don't know why that is. It just seems to be the case. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. What else?
Time, Jack.
Good. Yes.
Yeah.
Anything else you wanted to cover about Stephen's work? Because we have to get a song out of this. So if there's a particular direction you feel you need any more inspiration on?
Well, I do have some inspiration. Let me just see. Made some questions. Yes, I was going to ask. Oh, I've lost my video. Hang on. The Canadian national identity. We always, or in my opinion anyway, seem to have either an inferiority or a superiority complex towards America. So I was wondering, what's your take on Canada? Do you think about Canada at all?
Well, a lot of us lately are thinking about it as a place to flee to.
Right.
Given how the next election goes, I think to a lot of us of a certain political stripe, Canada sounds very modern and very advanced, mm-hmm. and very relative to the United States anyway, very progressive. We tend to note that you guys, by all reports, have a lot of guns up there, but you don't seem to be using them on a daily basis to mow down a mall full of people.
True.
There is clearly some difference between the Canadian character and the American character that has this inherent violence.
Yeah.
The right will make fun of Canada and will, as all kind of snowflakey and a bastion of squishy liberalism. But to the rest of us, Canada sounds okay. I've even sort of, fantasized in my head, in my more whimsical apocalyptic daydreams of Canada annexing the West Coast. California, Oregon, and Washington.
Right.
We all become a part of Canada.
I have heard people say that before. Yeah. Yeah.
I can even see the map, with a little comma, inverted comma there. So that's, I think a lot of people have a pretty, maybe even unrealistic view of Canada.
Yeah, that is possible. I briefly lived in New York, and when moving back to Toronto from being in New York, one thing that struck me was the idea that Canada's progressivity, progressivism, whatever the noun is, may not be false exactly, but it's sort of assumed. And so Canada doesn't necessarily talk about racism, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So the vocalism of people in the US talking about issues, I think, doesn't necessarily get addressed as much in Canada. Probably to the society's detriment, but that's hard to say too.
So it would be better if Canadians were talking more about this stuff.
Yeah, that was my impression. And I mean, I'm sure that comes from British heritage where you suppress your emotions and don't talk about the issues. So it's ingrained cultural activity, but yeah, maybe talking about things would improve things. It's hard to say.
The times that I've been to Toronto, I liked it a lot, but yeah. Living there.
Yeah, I mean, I like Toronto a lot too, but it is a challenging city to live.
Yeah.
What do you think of Trudeau? Because it seems that what you were talking earlier about the left meeting the right at the back, you know, he seems to be like, you know, what he did with the truckers and like taking, if you donated to the truckers, you got your bank accounts closed and, you know,
yeah,
he's cutting down a lot of free speech there. He's really, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Trudeau for basically what you've said, that he has this sort of token progressivism that isn't really accurate to his character.
Yeah, super controlling, yeah.
Is there another better option or a viable option?
To be honest, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people here are disappointed in Biden, but I keep explaining to them that because a choice is imperfect doesn't mean it isn't clear.
Yeah, this is true. I think the big difference with Canada is we don't vote for the prime minister. We vote for the party.
Yeah.
So that does change the mindset behind the political process too.
Yeah. I haven't seen as many great choices over there. Well, both of the options are older than you, Stephen.
Yeah. But it's still a clear choice.
Yeah.
If that's the choice we wind up with. I personally, I've kind of reluctantly, I was for Biden the last time. I was for Biden because I believed then, I believe now that he had the best chance of beating Trump. And it was a purely practical consideration.
Sure.
I've kind of reluctantly come to the conclusion that it would be better if Biden would drop out. I think his age has so permeated the collective perception of him that even the good things he's done or tried to do, and he has done and tried to do good things, are just not on people's radar. They're not seeing past the fact that he's old, and that isn't going to get better.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah. Cool. Well, I think we've had a good conversation here, giving me some ideas to work with.
Yeah. Jack, do you have something you can work with?
Definitely. Yep. Really super excited.
Great.
Cool.
Thanks so much for taking the time to chat. I know you're super busy and we really do appreciate you taking the time.
No, I'm honored and flattered that you asked me. So thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll stay on for a few moments, talk about the song, and we'll send it to you as soon as it's ready.
Okay, great. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah. Put a man to meet the man behind the words.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Wonderful. So you were inspired for a song? You feel like you've got enough to work with?
Yeah, I think I have some ideas that might result in something.
Okay. Brilliant. Well, send it over when you have some ideas and we can also mix it this end and, add on some sounds as well and make a real collaboration.
All right. That's cool.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I hope to speak to you soon. Have a great Christmas.
All right. You too.
See you next year.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the song and the episode. The song will be released next week. It will be available on all streaming platforms, but you can already pre-save. Please support the artists by following them on social media and adding the song to any playlists you have. This is a completely free show, and you've listened this far, so I'd really appreciate it if you could pay us back by clicking like and subscribe. And follow at Podsongs on social media platforms, or subscribe to the newsletter at podsongs.com for special updates. Or just tell the next person you see about this amazing show where musicians interview their idols and write a song about them. The songs are available for download from the Podsongs website as well, which pays a lot more than the 0.00 whatever we get from Spotify. You can also email me at jack@podsongs.com to give feedback, suggest an artist and guest combos you'd like to hear, or just say hello. We're a listener-supported show, and I'd love to hear from you. A final thanks to my researchers, Dori Verbo and Rosa Marino, my producer, Maurizio Sanicola of Goldmine Records, and musicians Massimino Vozza and Luigi Falcioni. The next episode will be out soon. In the meantime, you can listen to more amazing episodes in the archives. Until then, have a great day.